So for those of you who were here last week, or those who weren't here last week, we did the exercise on fear, exploration of fear, and how it is for you. And today I thought of following that with my reflections on the topic of fear. And perhaps there'll be some time at the end we can continue our discussion of it. And in thinking about fear this last week, fear and anxiety, I was very conscious that I became increasingly aware of all the different varieties of fear there are and all the different things we can be afraid of. And it seems like it's such a huge theme and topic that I felt reluctant to make any single statement about fear, any kind of simple kind of approach to it or, you know, singular kind of understanding of it. I overcame my reluctance. By thinking about one of the ways that mindfulness practice works is that it's meant to, one of the things it's meant to do is to clarify what our relationship is to what is arising, what's happening in our experience. And our relationship, and so one of the simple ways of approaching fear is not to look at fear, the issues of what you're afraid of, and the origins of the fear, the reason why that fear is there, but rather to look at what the relationship is towards fear. And so it makes it very simple. How do I relate to this issue of fear? Do I relate to it? There's common strategies that we have towards fear. Some people's strategy is always to run away from it, to be afraid of their fear, to escape and retreat, to go into escape mode, distract themselves from what they're anxious about or to run away. Some people's attitude towards fear is to strike out, to push it away or to attack or to get angry. What is the relationship that we have towards fear? So one of the very simple approaches we have in mindfulness is to look at what is the relationship you have to the presence of fear. And of course, in different situations, there might be different relationships you have. But many people have a common pattern in their relationship to fear. They tend to be maybe more a type that kind of pulls away from fear, or more a type of person who lashes out in the presence of fear. I had a conversation with someone today who I said a simple statement to. It was rather innocent, I thought. I think the person was afraid. And later the person called me to apologize about what had happened. And the person self-described him or herself as being, having gone ballistic. and as being kind of the object of the, you know, interballistic missile. It felt like, you know, I was being attacked. And I felt like I was the person who was needed to apologize for having done this tremendous affront. But that person was basically just afraid. And the person reacted to their own fear by this, you know, attack and anger. And so what's their relationship to, what's our relationship to fear? Now, in asking that question and investigating that issue, we're doing something very important. And that is, for many of us, is we're changing our relationship to fear in that very investigation. Instead of being caught up in our aversion to fear or caught up in our aggression or whatever it might be, our common patterns, suddenly there's a new relationship to fear, and that is a relationship of investigation, of curiosity. And if that sense of curiosity or investigation or interest is strong enough, it can completely override the gripping power the fear has over us. If it just, you know, if the interest is not so strong, then perhaps the power of the fear can override the curiosity. But as the mindfulness gets stronger, as a person gets more confidence in the value of mindfulness, then they can bring to bear on almost any situation, including fear, a kind of interest or investigation which can really make the whole situation much more workable and easier just doing that. You don't have to understand the fear, you don't have to, you know, get rid of it or resolve it, but simply when interest investigation is powerful enough, it has a way of distancing us from the fear, or disentangling us from a fear, pulling us outside of its gravitational pull and field, so that we don't feel like we're enmeshed and identified, defined by the fear. So what's the relationship with fear that you have? And there's a wide range of them. Some people love their fear when it's, or they rely on it when the fear is relatively mild. The college term paper syndrome. You know, you put it off, you put it off, you put it off until the last evening. And part of what really gets you going, and even gets the creative juices going, and gets you really to do it, is that suddenly you realize, oh my God, you know, I'm going to fail this class. I'm going to drop out of college. My parents are going to be angry with me. I'll be homeless, you know. This is it. And so some people rely on fear to get them motivated. And so they feel a certain kind of fondness for their fear. They depend on it. And they don't want to get rid of it. But that kind of dependence on fear, I feel, is related to the similar kind of dependence some people have on anger, where they use anger to get them motivated to do things. They feel really angry at some wrong that's been done, and so they go out to right the wrong. There's nothing wrong with righting a wrong at all. We should do that, by all means. But when it's motivated by anger, it's painful. It causes suffering for you. So anger is always, you know, suffering producing. It isn't that we have to ignore the wrong, but or the need to write the term paper. But one of the things we're trying to find through mindfulness practice is a motivation that can get us really going to do things that we need to be done, that's not based on us kind of being contracted or suffering or getting tight or uptight. It's not based on either anger or fear. A lot of people don't know that kind of level of motivation. They've never relaxed enough, and in the relaxing, trusting mode, allowed some kind of more organic sense of powerful motivation to surface. They don't feel safe to let go of their sense of control that sometimes comes into play when we latch on to fear or latch on to anger to get things done. So our relationship to fear, it doesn't take a lot of reflection to see a lot of the painful acting out that fear has in our society. I think of some people, you know, politicians will use our fear for getting their votes or passing certain policies. Certain people have certain political beliefs that the belief system they have is really an expression of their fear. And it's their kind of, they see the world as a threatening place. And so they come up to the whole political point of view, a whole philosophy of life, a whole religious point of view of how to approach life that is based on the notion that things are a threat, that world is a threat, that there's something to be afraid about. It's not necessary to see the world as constantly being a threat. There's other approaches. Fear can color our world dramatically, can really make us see blindly what's out there. I've been in situations where I've been afraid of someone only to realize the person was far from dangerous. The person was actually very friendly. But my own fear colored my perception of the person until I got to know the person better. And as I've said, I've had that a lot of times, enough times now that, you know, that I don't believe my fear always when it comes up. I'm afraid of that person. I'm willing to stop and say, oh, I'm just afraid. It's based on my fear. I know the gut feelings of fear. I know the sensations of fear when they're there. And because I know the sensations of fear when they're present, I kind of arise kind of suspicion in my mind. Okay, the way I'm seeing this person right now, is it being informed by this kind of contraction in my body? Before I knew this little trick, I wouldn't know that I was contracted. I just know what my opinion of that person was. But when I'm contracted, it's like a cue. It says, oh, wait a minute, your opinion maybe is not so accurate. or maybe it needs to be tested, or maybe it needs to look more carefully. So we learn to look at our relationship to fear, and we learn to look at what fear is itself. To just simply study our fear and feel it physically in the body, to get to know it really well, then allows fear to be what it may be meant to be, which is a signal. It's often, sometimes a useful signal. There are things to be afraid of in the world, and you should be afraid of them. But 99%, I suspect, of the times in our society, when people are afraid, they're being afraid in situations probably that don't need to be fear-producing. Our society has been called, we've been told we're living in the age of anxiety. And one of the definitions of anxiety is it's fear based on our imagination. Anxiety is seemingly always to do with something in the future, the possibility of something happening in the future that we're afraid of. And that relies on our imagination. And the stronger the powers of imagination, the more anxious you can become. If you're one of those people who are blessed with a very poor imagination, then maybe you'd have, you know, very little anxiety. But it's very powerful to realize that anxiety arises out of our thoughts and ideas that are suppositions about what might happen in the future. One of the little pieces of wisdom that I've acquired painfully and through a lot of repetition, it's one of the unfortunate facts of wisdom that wisdom sometimes only arises from familiarity. And why it's painful is familiarity sometimes takes a long time to get familiar with something. Repeated, see a certain pattern over and over and over again. And finally it dawns on you, oh, that's how it is. And so one of those for me was, I would get anxious about the future. I used to get, you know, 10 years ago, I used to be anxious about coming to our group here and giving a talk Monday night. And, or all kinds of situations. And what happened was that I started noticing that often it didn't turn out the way my imagination expected it to turn out. And so for a while I just noticed that. And then it dawned on me, what a bunch of wasted energy. You know, I probably could have powered the California during its blackouts if I just, if I got plugged in. You know, over and over again, you know, I was worried about stuff that didn't turn out that way. You know, I show up for some event and the event was canceled. You know, or, you know, it was just somehow was different than how I imagined it was going to be. And then, you know, just was a wasted worry. And so, through the familiarity with that process over and over again, I started to become more relaxed about the future. And so I'm less likely to get anxious now about what's going to happen in a week or a month or later in the day. So we study our relationship to fear, and we study the fear itself. You get to know what the fear is like. And then the fear can function as a signal that helps us understand our life better. Now, sometimes it's a signal of a real danger. And sometimes it's a signal, it's time for you to look at yourself more carefully. It's time for you to come to terms with your own fear because maybe it's unfounded. But whether it's a founded fear or an unfounded fear, learning not to be caught in the grip of fear is very helpful. And the example that I think for me is very significant of this is when I was a relatively new student at the San Francisco Zen Center, which was in a very dangerous neighborhood in San Francisco. And there were lots of the Zen students were mugged, held up at gunpoint, shot, stabbed. It was a regular event on the street corner there to be activity. And there were some remarkable stories of some of my friends who would say that they were being held up at gunpoint or knife point, and they were able to stay calm during that event. And because they were able to stay calm, they seemed to know, and their adrenaline was probably going at the same time, but they kind of knew, they kind of had some kind of ability to stay mindful and present. And because of that, they were able to figure out or know what was the necessary thing to do to kind of get through the situation in a safe way. Both men and women have told me this story, and they attribute it to their meditation practice. Having sat for a number of years, they were able to stay calm and stay mindful in the midst of it. Of the people I've talked to, all the ones who I've talked to about their being held up, who attribute staying calm to their meditation practice, got through it beautifully. The person who didn't do it, didn't stay calm, even though he had a number of years of practice, he ended up in jail. not the mugger. Because he acted out in a really silly way. And when I thought about this, then I remembered, what I realized is that the way that fear is addressed in Western Dharma circles, Western Vipassana circles, seems to me to be generally quite different than how it's addressed in Southeast Asian Buddhism. And the general distinction between these two forms is a tendency in Southeast Asia is for the practitioners to focus on developing their inner strength of calmness and concentration and letting go, so that they can be independent of the fear, so they don't get caught by the fear. The general tendency in the American Vipassana circles, I believe, maybe there's different opinions about this, is more psychological, that you should go and investigate the fear and understand the causes of it, learn how to dissect it, learn how to be really present for it in the body, really go into the fear directly. And there's lots of great stories in Southeast Asia of the monks going off and sitting in the jungles with sometimes intentionally to confront their fears, but sometimes because that's what they do, they sit in the jungle. And back in one or two generations ago in Thailand, there were tigers and big poisonous snakes and wild elephants and all kinds of poisonous and dangerous things in the forest and the jungles. And the monks would go, unarmed by themselves alone, and they would end up sitting in a cave or sitting someplace in the middle of the night, and a tiger would walk up to them, and they would kind of look a tiger in the face. Or sometimes they're sitting meditating and they hear the tiger walk up and they hear it snarl and feel its breath or whatever, and they would say, okay. And this is very common, at least the way it's recorded, from people who survived. they would say something like, this is it. If I'm going to die, if this is my time to die, then this is my time to die. There's nothing I can do about it. And if I'm going to die, I'm going to die devoting myself to the Dharma. I'm going to die in the Dharma, kind of. And so they would just sit there and they wouldn't flinch. And they would just really try to develop their concentration, really stay with the breath, stay with their object of meditation, develop their concentration, try not to get caught by the fear, not to run away, have the mind run away by the fear, but stay detached from the fear. And sometimes stories, dramatic stories of kind of shivering and breaking out into sweat. And of the ones who survive, there's always this moment where they break through psychologically, and then suddenly this tremendous peace and light appears, and they kind of get freed of their fear, and then dawn occurs and they realize that they're still alive and they're ready to tell the story. Now, I think it's Ajahn Amaro or Ajahn Tanissaro says that there is no recorded evidence of a monk ever being eaten or in Thailand. So maybe, the tigers aren't as dangerous as they are purported to be, but there's lots of these kinds of stories. The other kind of stories is stories of going into cemeteries. Thais seem to be particularly afraid of cemeteries in a way that a lot of people in the West maybe are not as afraid of cemeteries. Though I suppose a lot of people in the West would prefer not to spend the night in the cemetery. Mm-hmm. But so the monks would intentionally go out and spend the night in the cemetery meditating. And the stories that survive are inevitably the ones where the ghosts visit. And so there's, you know, something really comes along and they sit there and the same thing, they sit there committed. So these are very dramatic stories. I use these stories as an example for this approach that's kind of not psychological. But rather what the person's doing is developing the strength of their concentration, their calmness, their ability to let go. In the same way that these Zen students found that their own inner powers of concentration and calm and letting go had come with their meditation practice and then was translated to situations where it was really needed. And this is a very important principle, that you build inner strength by a regular meditation practice. And that inner strength then becomes a foundation that's useful in times of crisis. It's certainly, you know, in times, if you find yourself in times of crisis, it's certainly useful to bring mindfulness to bear. But you might not be able to have much ability to bring mindfulness to bear on the situation when you're so caught up in the crisis. But if you have a regular daily sitting practice and you build the inner strength, then that strength comes along with you into the point of crisis. And the whole situation can be radically different. Sometimes when a fearful situation is strong enough or enough anxiety arises, to bring attention to it or be present for it can be counter-indicated because you only get more anxious, end up with a panic attack. And the wise thing to do is not to be present for it, not to be mindful of it, but to know actually to pull away from it. Maybe to do loving-kindness meditation or take a very big, spacious, open, kind of open sky meditation, or just focus on the breath in a very simple way. But when the strength of mindfulness, strength of concentration is there, then it's possible to turn the attention very directly at the fear itself. And here in the West, in the Vipassana circles, we focus, I think, much more on the psychological approach in the sense of, if you're afraid, bring your attention to the fear. And focus on the fear and learn how to be free of the fear, independent of the fear, by being really present for it. Now this is counterintuitive for a lot of people here because a lot of people are uncomfortable about their fear. Fear is sometimes, usually, an uncomfortable situation. It's an uncomfortable feeling. And many people recoil from any discomfort. But the common instruction in mindfulness is you go into what's really going on. You bring your attention and hold it there with a fear. One of the ways to do this that's very useful is to feel the fear or the anxiety in your body. Feeling in your body grounds the experience in something that's different than the imagination, the thoughts and ideas you have of what's going to happen. The physical sensations of fear are often much easier to be present for than the whole kind of shebang of fear, what you're afraid of. So maybe sit down, if you're afraid of something and it's not, you know, the tiger that's actually coming, maybe if you see a tiger in Palo Alto, maybe you should call 911 or something. But you close your eyes and sit quietly and just feel physically what's going on, what the fear is. And where do you feel it in your body? And then ground your attention in that place in the body. As one of my friends who sat the three-month course said, it's a three-month retreat, and he had a lot of fear. He's a fear-type person. And a lot of panic came up for him. And he discovered, with kind of an aha kind of moment, that his fear was a lot of, in his case, was a lot of constriction in his chest. He said, oh, I can be present for a constriction in my chest. And that little moment, oh, I can do that at least, gave him a little toehold, a little crack in his psyche, so he can learn to start being present for his fear and not always recoiling or reacting or kind of having it be a kind of cycle that gets bigger and bigger. So we ground it in the body as a way of not being tripped out by the thoughts connected to the fear or the anxiety. And then we learn to be with it. How are we relating to this? How am I relating to the physical sensations of fear? Am I resisting it? Am I bracing myself against it? Am I attacking it, trying to get rid of it? And always trying to massage that relationship we have with the experience to see if we can be non-reactive, which means just allow the experience to be there by itself. One of the marvelous things about experience, in one kind of interpretation of Buddhist teachings, is that everything, all experience, is self-liberating. If you can know how to be present for things in a non-reactive way, all things will liberate themselves, will free themselves. So you don't have to be afraid of your fear, but if you can bring your attention to your fear fully, that fear will process itself, will release itself, will resolve itself, just simply because you're holding your attention in a non-reactive way for that. Non-reactive awareness allows for the self-liberating process of our life to unfold. As you begin to have more confidence in how things self-liberate, then you can have more confidence that it's okay just to bring this non-reactive awareness to whatever arises. What's happening now? What's happening now? As we begin being more present and stable and willing to be with fear in the body, then at some point you might turn your attention to what's going on in your mind, to the thoughts and ideas that are present when you're afraid. And as you begin looking at the thoughts, then your relationship to those thoughts might also shift. And one of the very radical moments, again, in mindfulness practice, is when a practitioner can look at a thought, any thought, and realize, oh, that is just a thought. Oh, that is just a thought. Because often we're kind of entangled with our thoughts. We think our thoughts are true, and especially when they're connected to fear, fear has a way of making our thoughts seem very compellingly true. But do we believe our thoughts? Do we identify with the thoughts? Are the thoughts kind of reality? If what we're anxious about in the future, we kind of almost as if it's really happening already in our imagination. But it's just a thought. It's like a television show that the mind has produced. You know, we look at our television show or we go to the movies, and I guess we get caught up in the movies, right? You know, that's part of why we get, suddenly the tiger jumps out, you know, in the movie screen and everybody cringes in their seats. But if you really kind of pay attention to what's going on, if you kind of look around the movie screen, movie theater, and look at all those heads bopping up and pulling back and, you know, and listen to the crunching popcorn, and you realize, you know, nothing's going on up there. It's just a movie. Then suddenly it kind of can pop the bubble out of the way in which we're enchanted by what's going on up there. It's possible to have the same release from our thoughts. We say, oh, it's just a thought. Anyone who is involved in mindfulness practice, in a spiritual practice, sooner or later will have to confront their fear. Sooner or later will either have to do the traditional kind of Southeast Asian approach of developing a stronger presence, stronger concentration and mind that's stronger than the fear, so the fear has no hold on the mind. Or do the more kind of Western approach of going into the fear directly until, by doing that way, the fear no longer has a grip on the mind and we're free of it. everyone who does mindfulness practice, I believe, sooner or later will have to confront fear. Because what keeps us from being free is our contraction and fear. It's almost as if the Buddha said that the primary poisons that keep us in cycles of contraction and fear is greed, hate, and delusion. Greed, aversion, and delusion. And then the Buddhist tradition says, fear is a variety of aversion. So fear is a kind of subcategory of these first three. I've heard American Dharma teachers speculate. I remember Guy Armstrong giving a talk on fear once, and he said, Buddha said it, the primary root of all suffering is greed, hate, and delusion. And then he said something like, well, that's just one man's opinion. And he said, I suspect that fear is at the root, is really the root of it all. It certainly is for some people. And I've known a lot of people who have gone and started doing a mindfulness practice, and then their mindfulness practice has revealed to them, in a great shock, how pervasive their fear is in their life. They had no idea that fear insinuated itself in so many different aspects of their life. All aspects, it's always there. But the process of letting go, the process of waking up, the process of having an undefended heart, a heart which is clear and open and free, requires us to confront the places where we're protecting the heart, we're protecting ourselves. Because there's no freedom without the release of those holding. That's just a matter, there's no freedom without that. You might then immediately want to defend your holding and say, well, in some situations it's really important to defend myself. It might be. But it's still the fact that there's no full freedom without letting go of all the holding. And to let go of the holding requires us to look at the fear of letting go of that holding. Some people it's the fear of losing control. For some people it's the fear of vulnerability. For some people it's the fear of a kind of dying. I remember at some early point in my practice, fear became a very regular companion for me. And the fear had to do, I saw through my practice that I had, in order for me to be at ease and at home, be free, I had to let go of some of the common ego games that I played, some of the ways in which I defined myself to myself, the way I kind of talked to other people so they would, I was trying to kind of manipulate them so they would see me a certain way, and I depended on the kind of this, I had this ego game that I was playing, self-image that I was building up and trying to polish and defend and present to the world. And I came to this edge, it felt like a precipice, where I knew that if I was going to go any further in practice, I had to let go of that. And I knew what was required of me, but I was afraid. I mean, there was nothing to be afraid of around me. I mean, there was all these good people. I was living with all these kind, nice people. I'd go on retreats, and retreats are some of the most safest places in the world. You go to Spirit Rock, and you don't have to lock your door, and you can leave your wallet, with money bulging out, and and the buffet table where everybody walks by, right? And you leave money bulging, and you know it's going to be there when you show up later. It's one of the safest places in the world, probably, and except for the mountain lions. and people are terrified, So I was terrified. I wasn't terrified, but I was afraid because I saw this fear. I saw that I was up against this precipice. It felt like a precipice. I knew what had to be done, but I was afraid of letting go. And so I walked up to that edge many times and backed off. Up to that edge and backed off. But I kept massaging it. Even though I didn't have the ability to let go of it, I wasn't able to do what I thought I should be able to do, I just kind of matter-of-factly walked up to there and backed off. Walked up. But I was willing to at least walk up. I was willing to at least walk up and walk up and walk up. And slowly, I think what happened was, each time I walk a little bit further. Each time it's a little bit, stretch that little bit, and stretch a little bit. And finally, I think, you know, I don't know exactly what happened, because it's kind of a mysterious, unseen process. But it was as if the boundaries of fear got stretched and stretched and stretched, thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. And at some point they became transparent, like hardly see it anymore. And at some point, that level of fear just kind of seemed to just vanish. I've had a lot of my fear that I've confronted in my practice disappear when I wasn't paying attention. Now that's not a plug for mindlessness. It's a plug for not taking responsibility, that you're the one who has to do the work and fix things. But rather, I had to do my part of the work. I had to bring my mindfulness to bear over and over and over again. I had to be as mindful as I could. But then, you know, some point, you know, I'd come back to the next sitting. And where is it? Where is that big issue that I was confronting, I was so troubled by? I had to, in the sitting before, I had to put myself there and be up against the wall, up against the wall. But I learned that I don't have to solve the wall. Sometimes it would be solved, sometimes I'd see something, some insight. But sometimes just simply putting myself there, then I'd come back later and be gone, that problem. It seems to resolve somehow behind the scenes. So one of the things I'm hoping to convey in this talk today is the usefulness of being interested in your fear enough so that you'll study it, get to know it, and so one thing is an interest in your fear, and the second related to that is that a willingness to be present for it. Be interested in your fear, and then not only be interested in it, but also be willing to be present for it, to feel it, to learn what's there, to learn how to be free of it, to learn not to be fooled by it. It's not necessary to have your fear disappear. You don't have to get rid of your fear to be free of fear. You can have fear and not be in its grips, not have it limit you, and then you're fearless. Fearlessness does not require the fear to go away. And I've been in many situations where I've been afraid, and the fear, I knew what the fear was like. I recognized it when I was there. And in seeing it and clearly being a present of it, being familiar with the whole process of fear, the fear became like pesky little flies, kind of like in the background. They were kind of annoying to have there, but they weren't going to interfere with what I had to do and with my life. And I was content just to leave them there in the background. I didn't have to do anything about them. I became fearless in certain circumstances, even though those little flies were there, little voices were there. In the Buddhist tradition, people who become fearless are said to offer one of the great gifts that a human being can offer to others, and that's said to be the gift of fearlessness. And it's a marvelous thing to give the gift of fearlessness, to be able to meet other people and they have nothing to fear of you. And they sense in you a kind of deep trust where you realize that you're fearless. So those are my thoughts for today. So now it's your turn for your reflections or comments or questions. Yes?
I was struck that you made it sound as though you have one fear, or that one has one fear. You look at it in a certain way, and you're thinking, maybe what you're talking about is that the fear doesn't have to be about a particular step back far enough, you're just talking about the raw feeling in response to
Right. Yeah, it could be that way. There are so many different things we can be afraid of. Sometimes all the different fears we have might have a common root. And it might just be one single... It might be the fear of rejection. It might play itself out in all, you know, the fear of what I'm, you know, what do people think about, you know, what I'm going to wear, or the fear that maybe Macy's going to be closed because that's the place where I get the right kind of clothes, where I can wear those clothes in that particular setting and then people won't reject me. So there's you know, I don't know if that was a, you know, maybe a silly example, but there might be a common root that's sometimes discovered. And some people who are more fear-based than others sometimes have a common root. Some people it's a fear of death, fear of rejection. The fear of loss of control for some people. I've known people who, for example, sometimes when a parent has gone through mental illness, especially very dramatic, maybe they had to be institutionalized, and it happened when the person was a child, sometimes they'll spend, that person will grow up, and this constant kind of underlying fear of losing control or maybe have it happening to them. And that's kind of a common root of many other kinds of fears. But sometimes it's not a common root, but rather the if we study fear really well in one situation, it might translate to fear in other situations, because the smell and the feel, the texture of fear is very similar. And so if you learn how to deal with your fear of, you know, heights, it might work really well then to what all you've learned there, and the power and the strength of mind, mindfulness, and studying your relationship to fear that you've learned there, might translate very well in a completely unrelated situation, because it's still a fear.
It's not situation based.
It doesn't have to be. Yes, Mita.
For me, so much of fear used to be fear of loss, especially after I became a mother. And I think the interesting way that the mindfulness practice has helped me, and you know, fear of being old, fear of being poor, fear of my husband dying and being lonely, basically fear of loss. Meditation gave me a find a place of calm and happiness within myself that really didn't require much of anything else. And places where I could go there, you know, my child didn't exist, my husband didn't exist, my mother didn't exist, my house didn't exist, I didn't eat. And that kind of gave me a confidence in a sort of different way that almost any of these can go and there can still be happiness and peace. And that is not dependent on anything external at all, as long as my breath is.
Beautiful. That's very beautiful and very profound what you said. And ultimately in Buddhist practice, that's one of the things that's being pointed to, is that place of deep inner peace and happiness, where not dependent on anything in the world being a particular way. To realize that we have absolutely nothing at stake. At the core of who we are, there's nothing at stake. And then we can come out into the world and not be so caught by the other kinds of fears. I also discovered a certain kind of fear that I'd never had before after my son was born. And it's kind of like what I know what you're talking about also. It's kind of like sometimes I go back and forth between those two. And having one, having the freedom, that deep peace, makes it easier for me to be present for the fear of losing my son, for example. And that still stays with me. But because of my mindfulness practice, because of my willingness to recognize it, and my knowing this other possibility, it just stays as a very low-key little kind of tight pressure in my gut and my stomach. I know it'd be very easy, especially in the old days, for that to kind of swell up and become much more anxious and much bigger event. Because the practice, it stays there. It's kind of there, and I kind of feel, well, maybe it just comes with parenting. It's biological. It's just part of the scene, you know. It's like, this is what I signed up for. And you know, that's the way it is. And I'm glad I know, and I'm glad I know the thing you're pointing to also. Yeah.
I can't remember. I remember a Dharma talk in which someone spoke of meditation practice similar to the one where you meditate on death, where you would find something that you are afraid of, you're afraid of heights, and you would go meditate on a cliff somewhere. Mm-hmm. Seek out the fear and use it as a tool of meditation.
Sure. I mean, that's what I think some Thai monks would do. They would go in the forest or the cemetery either to confront their fear or to test. Am I really fearless now? Let's find out. And there was someone recently, I don't exactly know how the story, how the conversation went, but this is what happened, was someone asked, you know, in Thailand, people, the monks go off and nuns go off in the jungle and face the tigers in order to confront their fear. Should we do the same thing in America? Should we go someplace that's really frightening? And, you know, should we go down to the Tenderloin in San Francisco at midnight and meditate and in a dead-end alley? You know, to really deal with our fear. Or go, you know, someplace. And sometimes it's wise. I remember once there was a woman on retreat up at Vajrapani who had a lot of fear, and she chose to go off far off into the woods up there and to sleep in her tent far away from everyone else so she could really confront that fear of being alone out there in the dark. And she found it was very useful. She was very, you know, it was very terrifying for her, but she was found it very useful to confront the fear. But anyway, so this person was asked, I think it was a Thai monk, you know, should we in the West, should we do the same thing? Should we go find places where to sit where we're, you know, to face our fears? And the response was, you can just, you know, just sit down and and you know, it'll be there.
This is from the last week's. With the group we were in, there were two of us, me and another gentleman, who I guess you would call us adrenaline junkies, but at various points in our lives, including maybe currently, we actually go out and seek. You know, you ride your motorcycle fast on the roads, or you jump out of airplanes, or I am actually clinically acrophobic, right? There are times when I go up to an edge of a cliff and it's like, you know, dark, and you know, I know I'm going to throw myself off, and it's just absolutely amazing. And I worked for years as a high rigger. I started by going to the top of a ladder, and then I, you know, and finally I was looking at 150-foot grids without much difficulty. But that fear never went away. That I confronted it head on and I went with it because there was a certain adrenaline thing that happened, which was stimulated. Now, I'm not afraid. I seek fear.
Well, I'm not going to, I think there's probably a place to have fun, you know, with your fear. And certain kind of thrill, sometimes it's an okay thing to do. But, I don't know if this is not meant to be a judgment of you, but the it's possible that you could discover some other way of having the same kind of freedom and same kind of vitality that you get from confronting fear without dealing with fear. There's an innate tremendous vitality and freedom and delight and joy that is quite compelling. And if a person knows about that and has access to that, then they might lose interest in the kind of vitality and energy that comes, clarity that might come from going into fearful situations.
Well, the other thing is that I began to look at something else over the last 2 weeks, which is perhaps what I'm afraid of is being afraid, and I confront the fear and drive that back.
Huh? interesting. So, thank you very much, and may you all have a happy summer solstice.